You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories.
And welcome to episode 306, and in this one I chat with Dr. Ellie Leibowitz. Now, you may notice I got a bit of a sore throat. I don't during the interview because it was recorded a couple weeks ago. Eli created the treatment approach SPACE, which stands for Supportive Parenting for Anxious Childhood Emotions. SPACE is a parent-based treatment program for children and adolescents with anxiety, OCD, and related problems. Ellie is director of the program for anxiety disorders at the Yale Child Study. And it was great to get him on, and specifically we discussed his therapy story, why he focused on helping families of people with OCD, what SPACE is, the negative consequences of accommodation, what SPACE consists of, the two core elements of SPACE, which are responding in a supportive manner and reducing accommodation. He gives case examples, sticking points in SPACE and ways to overcome them, and much more.
And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the work that I do. NoCD offers affordable, effective, convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. If you wanted to find out more about their therapy services and whether they take your insurance currently, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/COCD stories, or the link will be in the episode description.
So thank you to Ellie for his time and to you guys for listening. As always, I appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Dr. Leibowitz.
Welcome to the show, Ellie.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So whenever I get a therapist or researcher on, I like to hear their journey, you know, what got them into to being a therapist or researcher, and then why specifically OCD?
Well, I've been interested in this area for a long time. And so what got me into being a therapist or a researcher is hard to answer, but it's been something I've been working toward and working on for many years. And I started out very early with a focus on OCD and anxiety problems. My PhD dissertation focused on obsessive compulsive disorder and on families affected by OCD. And I've been working in the area of OCD and anxiety for many years now.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. So yeah, your PhD thesis was on families affected by OCD. What made you like focus in on that as a PhD topic?
Well, I would say a combination of things. You know, I was working in an OCD and anxiety clinic, and was just really impressed by what I was seeing and hearing from families, from parents, even from siblings. And it just really crystallized for me the importance of focusing on the family system and not exclusively only on the individual level, on the individual level symptoms. Then another thing is that an early mentor of mine, since I did my training in Israel, and an early mentor of mine at Tel Aviv University was a name by the name of Omer, Chaim Omer. And he really devoted his career to the to families, to parents, and to the application of some really novel and thoughtful ways of working with parents, including in the domain of externalizing symptoms and problematic behaviors. And so we sort of came together around this issue, applying some of his thinking in the kind of parental presence domain to the obsessive compulsive area. And the dissertation actually focused on coercion in obsessive compulsive disorder and the ways in which some sufferers of OCD will sometimes impose a kind of obsessive compulsive regimen on the rest of the family. And so that became the focus of my dissertation.
Okay, cool. Thank you for sharing. And of course, this is relevant to the topic today because we'll be talking about SPACE, which is an intervention you developed. And so I guess let's just start there. You know, what is SPACE?
So SPACE, which stands for Supportive Parenting for Anxious Childhood Emotions, is a parent-based approach to treating obsessive compulsive disorder and anxiety problems in children and in adolescents. And it really is informed by a number of things. It's informed by the interpersonal and systemic view of these problems, because children will naturally look to their parents for help in coping with their anxiety. And parents will naturally respond by providing protection and reassurance. And often that translates into a high level of accommodation of symptoms. And so the family system and parents in particular will often be adapting to the symptoms of the patient. And so you get this kind of accommodation, but a lot of research really indicates that these accommodations, like participating in a ritual or listening to a child's confessions, for example, or performing checks with them, or performing cleaning rituals for the child, things like that, all those accommodations, they're well-intentioned. They're trying to help this child to feel better, but a lot of research indicates that they actually tend to maintain or even exacerbate the problems over time. And so SPACE aims to treat these problems by helping parents to change not their child's behavior, but actually to change their own behavior. And we could talk a little bit more about the details of that, but that's really the core of it. It's helping parents make changes in their own behavior so that children can get better and overcome these common and serious problems.
Yeah, that's, yeah. So, I'd love to get into the details, but I think initially it'd be good to, so just to clarify, you're not working with the kids necessarily. You're pretty much, they are the client, but you're not actually directly working with them.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The child is the patient. And so the goal of treatment is for the child to be doing better. And at the end of treatment, if that child is doing better, we've been successful. And if they're not doing better, then I would say treatment has not been successful. But the method, the means of achieving that aim is by working through the parent. So in most cases, the child isn't even going to be present in the therapy office. So as opposed to a typical therapy where a child, an individual might go meet with a therapist every week, learn some skills, etc., here it's the parents who are going to treatment every week. And not the child, but it's the child who is the patient and the person that we're trying to help. And this is really important because even though direct individual therapy with a child is a really well-established approach and helps and works in many cases, it doesn't work in every case. And there are also a lot of children who won't even do the treatment directly in the first place. Right? Everybody who does cognitive behavioral therapy or has been a patient in cognitive behavioral therapy or exposure and response prevention knows that that's a treatment that requires a lot of motivation, a lot of collaboration, and also ability on the patient's side. And so having an alternative that doesn't rely on that is actually really important and useful for a lot of families.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. Yeah, CBT works for many people, but it solely relies on the patient or client participating in a very highly engaged way, you know, doing all the homework, actively participating in sessions. So yeah, I like this as an alternative. So what age ranges does this apply to?
Well, most of our work, especially in my program, has focused on school age. And so we're talking about kids as young as about 6 and up all the way through adolescence. Now, there has also been work applying SPACE in younger children. There's a clinical study that was done in preschool age children. So we're talking about really young kids. And then there's also even what you might think of as upward expansions of the treatment, working with parents of adults, because sometimes someone who's struggling with mental health problems will sort of get stuck in life and remain very dependent on parents even after they're chronologically adults. But the bulk of our work has focused on school age.
Okay, so that's sort of 6 up to 16 or 18?
Yeah, 6 through about 17, right?
17, okay, cool. Yeah, so I guess just an open question then. Let's get into some of the details. You know, what does space look like and just anything you want to go into on that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the setting and what it looks like, is it essentially looks like therapy because parents are, you know, coming every week and meeting with a therapist and learning information and learning a skill and going home and practicing that at home and coming back and, you know, continuing the process like that. Space can also be done in a group setting. And so there's a lot of work being done applying this in groups and even clinical trial research to support the efficacy in groups. Now, in terms of what is actually happening in this treatment, the first thing I really want to emphasize, although in a sense I've already said it, is that the changes that we're making in behavior are all about the parent's own behavior. And so we're not sending parents home in space with the instruction to go home and make your child practice a skill, for example, or make them do an exposure, or not do a ritual, or things like that. Because I think what a lot of people realize, and what we've realized as well, is that that doesn't always work very well. Right? If a child's really engaged and motivated, that might work well. But when you send parents home with the instruction of you have to make your child do something, you're taking a little bit of a risk because sometimes it's not going to go that well. And then there's some potential for resistance, for conflict, for some escalation in that relationship, and you might end up doing more harm than good. And so we focus on changing the parents' own responses. And there are really two big picture changes that parents learn to make. And it's broken down into more specific steps, but really it's all about two things. And the first of those two things is for parents to learn to respond in what we would call a supportive manner, which is right there in the name of the treatment, right? The S in space stands for supportive. And so we're trying to help parents to respond in a supportive manner. And what we mean by support in space is to show your child two really important messages. One is showing acceptance, just validating your child's experience. Something is hard for them. It may not be hard for you. You may not feel the same way. You may not get it, et cetera, but you get it that it's hard for them. And it's really not possible to be supportive of somebody if you can't accept that this is their experience. So it can be really simple. It can be saying, like, I know it's hard for you, or I know this makes you really uncomfortable, or I know your OCD tells you X, Y, or Z. And that's just a very simple acceptance and validation of their experience. It becomes supportive when you combine that acceptance with a message of confidence, when you're also showing your child that you believe in their ability to tolerate some of that difficulty, to cope with it, to survive it, to get through it, et cetera, to ultimately be okay in the end. And that's a really important message as well. And neither one of those two ingredients is necessarily intuitively obvious to parents, or it's not always there in the way that we just naturally respond to the children. Sometimes we're not that accepting, right? We can be dismissive. Maybe we're trying to be helpful, but we say something like, oh, don't worry about it, or it's not a problem, or stop bugging me, or things like that. Sometimes we say, you know, just get a grip, suck it up, you know, don't be a baby, stuff like that. And, you know, those are not accepting messages. But the confidence is not always there either. A lot of times, children with anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder will grow up actually hearing themselves explicitly described as a child who can't handle these difficulties. They can't cope with their thoughts. They can't cope with their anxiety. They don't deal with stress well. All of those kinds of things, which seem to be factually correct, but they're also telling the child, you can't handle it. And there's no better way to increase distress and anxiety and symptoms in a child than to teach them that they can't handle those problems. And so we focus a lot on making these supportive statements, and parents will just learn, like, how do I say a supportive statement? Let's practice it. Let's role play it. Write some out. Go home and practice making those with the child. And that's the first of those two big picture, really important changes that parents make. The second focuses on accommodations. These are those changes that I was talking about a couple of minutes ago, the ways that parents are changing their own behaviors to help a child not feel the stress, not feel the discomfort or the anxiety linked to their symptoms. And accommodation was actually studied in obsessive compulsive disorder before any other disorder. Now it's very well established as a feature across all the anxiety problems and even beyond. But it was really first studied in OCD, and there's so much research showing that almost every single parent of a child who has obsessive compulsive disorder or another anxiety problem is going to be doing these accommodations and that they maintain the symptoms. So in SPACE, the therapist will help parents to identify what are the things that are accommodations that I'm doing and explain the rationale for why those aren't helpful, and then make some really clear plans for the changes that parents will make. Choose one thing, right? We don't say stop all the accommodations at once, which doesn't seem so doable and might be rather overwhelming for a child too. But instead, we'll say pick one thing. And in that one thing, we'll make a really detailed, clear plan with parents for what they're going to do different and for how they're going to communicate that plan to the child. And then they'll start implementing those steps at home.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. So the first part makes sense because you're telling them that these are just thoughts and feelings. They're not directly harmful. You know, they're not in any way going to physically danger you. Maybe not saying that, but that's that kind of, you can handle this. Because obviously when anyone at any age gets anxiety, it's this feeling of doom, and in reality is it's safe, you know. And you're kind of building that resilience in them to say, this is tough and I see that, but you're strong and you can handle this.
Exactly. I think that's the greatest gift that a parent can give a child with OCD or with anxiety. I think it's really the best thing you can do for that child is exactly what you just said, building that resilience, teaching them that it's okay, that they can handle it. It's uncomfortable. Mm. It's distressing, but they can handle it. And that, I think, just paves the way for a so much healthier and more functional and more gratifying existence, ultimately, over the very long term.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, good point. And then the other one, accommodation, which has come up on the podcast several times before, across all ages. And where's my question for this one? It was more around, you're saying pick one thing at a time and you're finding a way. It's almost graded. So you're not cutting everything out, because that's also quite severe for the child to suddenly be left in all that anxiety, but you're gradually doing it, and you're doing it over a certain amount of weeks or months. So I guess in terms of like change mechanisms or where the change is coming from, obviously we know if the parents aren't accommodating, then the child will learn indirectly to face their anxiety, and then their system will be calming down. But I guess where my head is obviously when we do ERP with a kid or an adult, they're directly facing their fears, their anxiety, and they're creating a new learning. So I guess, I don't know, my brain's kind of saying, well, if the parents do that, surely the kid needs to do it too. Obviously not in the case of your research, but I just don't know why that's not the case.
Well, here's one way to think about it. Yeah. I would say to parents, look, children, inherently, it's almost like they have two systems built in for regulating their own fear or distress. And one system is the one that's more similar to adults, right? Things that they can do to self-regulate. That can include anything, right? From breathing to cognitive things to distraction to behavioral things to, you know, like all of those things that adults can do as well to cope with fear, to regulate it, etc. However, children also have another system, and that is the more attachment-based system for down-regulating fear in childhood. Because children, like all mammals, are born with this predisposition that the like programming, essentially, to rely on parents when they feel scared. And even just the presence and proximity of a parent is often enough to downregulate fear to some extent. And then the accommodations that parents are doing are further helping to remove that fear. And in a typically developing child, what we'll see is a natural transition, a shift as they get older and their own capabilities tend, you know, are maturing. We'll see this shift away from relying on the parent and more toward individual, independent coping. So that by the time they are adults themselves, they're not relying on parents really at all for that, and they can in fact serve as the helper for their own children. But when a child has a lot of anxiety, when they're chronically experiencing anxiety, what often happens is that they get stuck on this interpersonal system. And so rather than developing their own abilities, it's like they're always just relying on the parent. And on the one hand, you know, it's really nice if there's somebody who can always rescue you when you feel bad. But needing to always be rescued is a really vulnerable place to be. In the same way that, you know, if a parent were always having to feed their child, right, like to spoon feed your child in order for them to eat, it would be great to have a parent around who can do that, but it would also be a really helpless kind of vulnerable place for the child, because how would you live independently in the world, right? What if you get hungry? Who's going to feed you? And so what we're saying in space, in a sense, is by reducing in a systematic and in a supportive and loving and warm and accepting way, but by reducing those accommodations, we are building in the child, we're fostering that ability for more independent coping. And it's really important to believe that those capabilities are there. They may seem small, they may seem weak or underdeveloped, but they are there. Children do have capacity for self-regulation. When you're always relying on the parent, you might not look like it, but it is there. And as parents make these changes, that capability and the child's belief in those capabilities is growing as well. So, you know, much like if you had a child with weak muscle tone, right? Like some babies are born with weaker muscles than other children, and things are, in fact, harder for them. Sitting up, turning over, standing, walking, these things are harder for them. But most parents get, and certainly most doctors would suggest, that the solution for that child is not always carry them around. Right? If you always carry your child around because they flop a little bit more or it's harder for them, those muscles aren't going to get any stronger. You have to believe what is in fact true. This child has the capability to learn to walk. It's just going to be a little harder for them. But if you let them work through that, that's going to grow and those muscles will get stronger. And so I think that's similar to what is happening in space. As parents are making these changes, those supportive messages are communicating to the child that belief. We're holding up a mirror to this child that shows them not as a weak, helpless, vulnerable child, but rather as a strong person who is struggling but can handle it. And reducing the accommodation puts in place the opportunities for them to handle it. And what we see is those capacities, those capabilities really growing and coming into the forefront in these children.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. That helps me understand better. I guess maybe one slight area that's gray for me still is, the children are learning to cope and come up with strategies. And is that different for each individual child, or is it that their brain naturally goes to kind of learning to tolerate fear and uncertainty and other emotions, and then the brain kind of learns that, oh, nothing happened and I'm okay? Thinking about inhibitory learning.
I think each child is going to experience it a little bit differently, right? There are children who will, you know, have an initial response that's going to look a little bit difficult. And in some kids, that's going to look a little bit like a temper tantrum, for example. Or in another child, it might look like distress of another form. But when you get through that, right, when you ultimately, half an hour later or an hour later, or sometimes just minutes later, you're feeling calmer, then you now have that experience of, I handled this and I handled it independently, right? I was able to get through it. And parents can really amplify that by praising their child, right? So if you didn't do the accommodation, maybe your child had a really hard time, but now a few hours have passed, now they're calmer. If you come to that child and you say, I'm so proud of you because you got through that moment and you handled it and now you're okay, A, you're validating the fact, I see that this was hard for you, but also you're showing them, right? Like, in fact, it's, yeah, that's right. I did get through it. You know, maybe I can I share an anecdote?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Well, I worked with a parent, or two parents really, of a young girl who was about 12 years old who had pretty severe obsessive compulsive disorder. There were a lot of symptoms throughout the day, but one of the symptoms was a lengthy nightly routine that involved the parents and a kind of confession ritual where the child would really review the entire day and the parents had to sit there quietly and listen. And then at the end, say like the magic formula of, you know, you didn't do anything wrong or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And this took a lot of time. And sometimes they'd have to do it three times instead of just once. And so that became the accommodation that the parents targeted in their space treatment. And they first let the child know in a really supportive way, we don't think it's helping you when we participate in that every night. We know it's hard for you when you have those thoughts that you might have done something bad, but we don't believe it's helping you and we know you can handle it. So we're not going to do that anymore. And this child was prone to extremely severe outbursts when she got upset. And it would be dramatic with the child yelling, screaming, chasing them around the house, and really hard to be around. And because of that, the parents actually made a plan that said that if this child were going into this kind of outburst and parents didn't feel like they could handle it, they were going to leave the house. And there was another adult who lived in their home, who was a grandparent, and they were going to leave the house and go sleep in a hotel for the night. And that's how scared they were of having to be around this, you know, this child if they weren't doing the accommodation. And in fact, that is actually what happened on the first night that they implemented their plan. Child predictably had a very strong reaction. And they actually did leave the house and grandma stayed to make sure kids okay, but they went and slept in a hotel. Now, in the morning, when the parents were back in the house to take the kid to school, the child came down for breakfast. And she looked embarrassed and sheepish. And that's how it usually would go because she would feel uncomfortable about having, you know, she literally drove her parents out of the house. And she looked really, you know, kind of worried. How are, what are they going to say to me? And this mother, who was so smart and so sensitive, she turned around to this child and said to her, I am so proud of you. And the child was taken aback. It's like, wait, why are you proud of me? I mean, I was like such a nightmare yesterday. And mom said to her, you got through last night without your ritual. That is such an like a light bulb moment for the child, right? It's like, yeah, you know what? That's true. And the sun still rose this morning. I even fell asleep at some point. And that kind of praise can be really impactful. And that's why in space, we have built into the treatment a set of tools to help parents cope with children's reactions. Because obviously, not every child is going to thank their parent on the first day that they start reducing accommodation. They're not always going to give them a big hug and say, wow, you really get the principles of like accommodation and space. Some of them will have a difficult reaction. We have tools built in for what do you do when your child says, you know, you don't care about me, or they're having a meltdown, or they threaten to harm themselves if you don't do the accommodation. These are frightening and difficult things for parents. And so there are tools for dealing with it. But I think it's really building in that child that experience of I was able to get through it, I did handle it, and that makes the next time easier. But not every child is going to have quite so difficult a reaction. I don't want to scare people from doing this treatment. That was a more severe reaction. A lot of children actually do have positive responses, even in the short term. And even when it's hard at first, that anger or that difficulty tends to be replaced very quickly with hope, with a positive experience of hope, because I feel like, yes, I can actually overcome this. I can get better.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great anecdote. Are there any other sort of anecdotes that come to mind that you think are worth sharing?
Well, I think there are so many, and anybody who you know works in the area of OCD or just has experienced it in their lives really can probably share their favorite story. we had a child who was probably about 13 years old and had a younger sibling, and who was only about 6 or 7 years old. And this older child, the 13-year-old, had also really severe OCD that was focused on contamination by her sibling. The people who are familiar with OCD will have maybe encountered this in the past. The way sometimes your contamination, it's not just about germs, but it could be about people, right? I don't want to be contaminated by that person. And so she had a lot of avoidance of her younger sister. And there was so much accommodation happening when I met this family. They, the mother, for example, would not only serve their food on separate dishes and have two sets of everything, like two ketchups, two mayonnaise, because nothing could transfer from one child to the other. But when this parent was washing clothes, for example, doing the laundry, she would not only have to wash the children's clothes in separate runs of the washing machine, and you can see how, you know, how burdensome that might be for a parent. I mean, doing the laundry without that is burdensome enough, but having to separate it all. But not only that, but she would run an empty load of the washing machine after the younger child clothes were in it and before she put the older child's clothes in. Or at the very least, she would promise the older child that she did do that. I think there may have been a little bit of cheating going on, but there was like so much accommodation. And believe it or not, all of that was not enough to bring this family into treatment. And what ultimately really led them to seek help was when the older sibling, the 13-year-old, came up with a new rule for the household. And this rule was that her younger sister, who was 6 or 7 and really wanted nothing more than for her older sister to just smile at her once in a while, you know, to just like play with her or talk to her because she looked up to her. But the 13-year-old made a new rule that says that the younger child is no longer allowed to cross her field of vision. So this is hard to envision, but you have to imagine if this 6-year-old girl wants to get a glass of milk, she would be charting a course from her room to the kitchen that guaranteed that her older sister wouldn't see her. And it starts to verge on the abusive, really, for this little child, right? Like, that's not the way a 6-year-old has to be living her life. Mm. And so there was a lot of work to do in reducing these accommodations, but it also does highlight that siblings will often be pulled into the accommodation as well. And we see that a tremendous amount. And in space, when we're working with parents, we'll usually focus on the parent accommodation because it's very hard to decide what the sibling is going to do. But we do think it's important to give the siblings a message that communicates to them that they're not expected to do those accommodations, that they don't have to. And in some cases, like with the 6-year-old, it also means standing by them and protecting them from any fallout if they choose not to accommodate.
Yeah, that's interesting. Gosh. So that got them into therapy and it worked, I assume, for that family?
Yes, it did. You know, they had been trying continually to follow the child's idea for how she's going to get better. She always had this idea that the way she would get better is just have like this long enough period of no exposure to her sister, to the point where parents had like taken vacations with the younger sister because like here, we'll have a week where you're not together. And of course it fails, right? Because it's you can't like argue your way out of it. You can't, like, it's always going to trick you up, right? It's like, you know, like, this is, you know, you do this ritual well enough and you'll never have to do it again. And it's always OCD lying to you in that sense. It's never going to work. But yes, treatment was successful. They were able to start really making that change, to move away from like, okay, we just need to do good enough accommodation so that you'll be fine, to a place of like, we get it. This is so hard and it's not your fault. And that's another important change as well, because sometimes, you know, there'll be some built up resentment, some built up conflict and anger because of the toll that the accommodation takes on other people. And so we're really moving away from that. We're saying that, like, we get it. OCD, it's such a hard problem to have. And it's not your fault that you have it. You didn't sign up for OCD, but we know that's not the way to help you. And so gradually making those changes. And of course, it took some time. So it's not like a 1 week process. Typically, when we're doing space, we're working 10, 12, 13, 14 weeks. So we're talking about a few months of therapy. But as they were able to make those changes, and the child was able to see that, you know what, I'm not able to make everybody dance to this tune of the accommodation, but I'm still okay. Her belief in herself started to improve and her symptoms started to go down. So by the end of treatment, she was doing so much better and actually became a lot more motivated to have a little bit of help for herself as well. And it is possible to do space alongside cognitive behavioral therapy. And sometimes we're just doing space, but other times it's also possible to do it alongside CBT. So this was a case where the child ultimately, you know, when she realized accommodation wasn't going to be the solution, she also said, all right, I'd like to have a little bit of help for myself. And I think that's actually a positive outcome as well.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask that. Yeah, it seems like it works perfectly with if the child, a young person, wants to do their own therapy, it almost fits perfectly in that.
Sure, absolutely. And I personally, when I'm the therapist, I actually think it works great to be one therapist who's doing both treatments and is working with the parent and is working with the child. Some therapists may prefer to split it between two, or maybe because of their skill set or because of, you know, something else they may prefer. And that's okay too, as long as you have some level of coordination or communication between the two therapists. But I actually think it works really well to have one person who's just working with the family and guiding the parents and guiding the child. And I have found that even though therapists sometimes fear that if they work with the parents this way, the child will be angry at them and won't want to work with them anymore, I actually find that that's not true. And I think one thing that really helps is the level of transparency that we keep in space. So there's no secrecy about it. We're very transparent. And so I would say openly to the child, I'm going to be giving your parents homework and this is going to be their job. And some of that might be hard for you. Like, I'm going to suggest things like this or things like that. And they know what's coming. They understand it. And sometimes they'll be like, you know, make a face at you because they don't love the idea. But I actually find that it strengthens the alliance and the bond with the child patient as well.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as you're honest, they'll usually be okay with it. But when it's just space, so you're not doing anything with the young person or child, so just space, just parents, do the parents tell the young person that, hey, we're seeking help to help you, and we're going to stop buying you shampoo, for example, in a washing compulsion, or are they kind of not telling the young person that they're stopping accommodation?
We do tell. We do tell the child, always. Yeah. We always tell the child. Almost always, the child will realize anyway that you're getting consultation from somebody.
Yeah,
you know, when you start speaking differently, when you start behaving differently, they're going to realize, like, wait, that's not the way you usually do it. But really, there's no reason to tiptoe around this, right? It's the most natural thing in the world. We're your parents. We're concerned about you. This is a serious problem. It's our job to help you, and we're going to get help from anybody that we think can be helpful to you, because we care about you much too much to just not do anything when we see how you are struggling. So I think if you put it like that, it's not something you need to tiptoe around, and it's something that is the most natural thing in the world. We also, in space, will always let the child know in advance about any plan that the parent is planning to enact. Right? If we're going to stop buying the shampoo, if we're going to stop answering your question, if we're going to stop going around the house to check the locks with you at night, if we're going to do anything like that, we'll always let the child know in advance. And actually, in space, we have like a really well thought out method for how to let the child know, because it's really important. We want to provide the rationale. We want to couch it in that supportive framework. And so we work very methodically with parents on how to let the child know, and also how to deal with their reactions when you do let them know.
Yeah. Okay. That clears it up a lot more for me. Okay. So let me look at my questions. I guess the question came up for me: are there any sticking points when working with the parents to get them to adhere to this program?
are there any sticking points? Well, I would say this is probably not the easiest treatment in the world. It's challenging, right? Like you're asking parents to do some hard things. Some sticking points, for some parents, it's not intuitively obvious. Why do you want to work with us, right? Why not my child? I mean, I'm not the one with the problem. And so we would, you know, we'll work to provide that rationale. And very importantly, also to make clear that we're not working with parents because we think this is their fault. You know, sometimes parents will be a little bit defensive because they think, well, you know, if the doctor wants to talk to me about how I'm doing as a parent, then I must be messing it up, right? Or they think that I'm doing something wrong, or maybe I caused this problem in the first place. And that's not it at all, right? I'm not working with parents because I think they gave their children OCD. I don't believe that at all. And so I'll really make that clear. And when you can put aside that issue of criticism, of blame, being able to help your child is an incredibly empowering and gratifying experience for parents, right? It only feels bad if I feel like I'm being blamed for something. But being able to help my child overcome a problem, like what could be better than that as a parent? It's a wonderful experience. Some parents will have a lot of anxiety themselves, and that can be a challenge in the process. And of course, it's natural that given the rates of anxiety in the population, and also given the links between anxiety or OCD in families and between children and parents, some parents will have a good dose of their own anxiety or even their own obsessive compulsive disorder. And that will require some attention in the treatment too. Doesn't mean that they have to go to their own therapy necessarily, but we might have to adapt for that a little bit. We might go a little bit slower than we might with another child. We might need to do a little bit more psychoeducation with the parent about anxiety, et cetera. And I think one other sticking point that I'll mention is two parents working together is not always easy, right? And you know, anybody who works with parents will very quickly realize that there's like a lot of hurdles to a good harmonious working relationship and cooperation between two parents. There are a lot of things that can get in the way of that. Some of them kind of more directly relating to the anxiety problem. Like maybe we see it differently. Maybe we have different ideas about it. And some of them completely unrelated, right? Like just some marital stressors and things like that. And so in SPACE, we also have a set of tools for helping the two parents to get on the same page about it. We're not doing couples therapy. We're not trying to address every aspect of their relationship, but just some tools for getting enough to be able to do this treatment together.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I was going to say, Jen, do you ever get the, you know, one parent just doesn't want to be involved?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And when that happens, we'll make an effort. And so will that other parent have one conversation with me, for example? Are they willing to meet with me or even talk on the phone one time so that I can understand what is the reluctance, right? Do they not think there's a problem? Do they not believe in therapy? Do they not like this treatment in particular? And I'll do my best to try to address it. But when I cannot, if I can only work with one parent, that can still be effective. And that's a really important message for parents to know. Even if your partner, your spouse, your ex, et cetera, even if the other parent is not on board, and maybe they're not going to follow this, you know, treatment guidelines at all, you can still have a really important and powerful effect on your child just by focusing on your own behavior. And we don't try to get that parent to sort of get the other parent to do it because they've already told us that they don't want to. And if I can't get them to do it, I don't think that the other parent is going to be a lot more successful. But just focus on your own responses, and that can still be really impactful.
Thank you. So we're going to move on now. So is there anything else you wanted to say on SPACE before we kind of change direction?
Well, I just want to point to a couple of resources.
Yeah, please.
Parents relating to SPACE, and two in particular. One of them is a website, and that is spacetreatment.net. And on that website, parents can find many, many resources, including a lot of information and also links to like articles, both research and kind of lay media articles. There's also a list of providers, of therapists who have trained in this method. Or if you are a therapist, there's information on training. How do you get trained in doing space? So I really recommend anyone who's interested in any of this to check out that website, spacetreatment.net. The other resource I want to mention is a book. And this is a book for parents called Breaking Free of Child Anxiety and OCD. And this is a step-by-step workbook, essentially, for implementing this treatment on your own. So even if you're not working with a therapist, you can still use these tools by following the information in the book. And a lot of parents have found this to be really helpful with their own child. And some parents actually combine the two things and work with a therapist working through the book. And that's a nice way to do it as well. But even just on your own. So the book is called Breaking Free of Child Anxiety and OCD. So those are two, I think, really important resources.
Yeah. Cool. No, I appreciate that. And anyone listening, I'll put the links in the show notes so you can go direct to those. Okay. So obviously, I'm sure you're learning a lot all the time about space. So it could be that. But just OCD generally, is there anything you've learned about OCD, whether it's the treatment or understanding the condition in recent years?
Wow, that's a broad question. There's so much work, so much research.
Well, the most interesting thing you think you've
interesting done. Thing. One thing that I think anybody who's working in OCD quickly realizes, but that's not always obvious to people who are suffering from OCD, is what do these thoughts mean? Meaning, it's very easy for us to think of our OCD thoughts as revealing some hidden thing about us, some secret impulse or desire, some, you know, things like that. And a lot of times, if you have OCD, that can make you feel really bad and really sad, because you might have really horrible thoughts. And if they are revealing some awful thing about you, that sounds really, really bad about you. What I say to all of my patients about OCD thoughts is that they teach us only one thing about you. They teach us what you're scared of, what you fear, not what you want, not who you are. They teach us what you fear, because that's the engine, right? That's the, or the fuel that drives the engine of OCD. And I've worked with thousands of people with OCD. None of them had an obsessive thought that they would win the lottery. Because people aren't typically very frightened of winning the lottery. Maybe they should be, but they're not. And so that doesn't become an obsessive thought. And if you do have an obsessive thought about winning the lottery, it's because it does scare you, right? And I think that's just such an important message for really anybody who's dealing with this problem in their lives.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it. Absolutely. Okay, so a couple of really random questions now. So you could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old you. What do you tell him?
If I picked up the phone and told and spoke to 20-year-old me, I would tell them that sometimes those moments in your life when you think things are going wrong, or are going in the opposite direction of what you thought or what you planned or what you expected, those might be some of the best moments. Those might be some of the best things that are happening to you. Because there have been, over the course of my life, multiple times when something didn't work out for me and I was so disappointed and so frustrated and so upset. And yet I look back now and I see that's the best thing that happened to me, because it led me to where I am today, and I couldn't be happier with where I am today. And so I think sometimes as we're going through day-to-day life, it's so hard to see that. And we're so wrapped up in what we think or what we planned. And when something deviates from the plan, it's really hard to feel okay about it. But I would want to tell me, don't worry about it that much, because you don't know what's good news and what's bad news.
Yeah, I completely agree. I like that. You've got a billboard where you live. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
I want written on that billboard, that the world is full of children who used to have OCD and children who used to have anxiety. Because I think that when you're struggling with these problems, it's so daunting. It's so discouraging sometimes. And if we take a step back for a moment and remember that these are treatable problems, that you know, what you're experiencing today doesn't have to be what you're going to experience every day for the rest of your life. I think that's a ray of hope that I would want to give to as many people as possible.
Yeah, I like that. And lastly, anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
No, I think this has been such a great conversation and really good questions and really thought-provoking. And so I just hope that it proves to be useful for other people.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your time. And I wanted to cover this method because, like you said, CBT doesn't work for everyone and there needs to be other solutions and or combinations with ERP. And I think this is a great one for probably many people.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.